Thank you, David. All right, in Matthew 5, the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, where we've kind of started at chapter 4, 23, and we've looked our way through this, what Jesus said about living, what Jesus says about living. And this message in Matthew 5 through 7 does for the spirit of man what Jesus began to do for the physical ailments of man at the end of chapter 4, as he made known the good news of the kingdom of God. And we saw what Jesus announced about the ones who are really blessed and the Beatitudes, then the influence of people like that, that he means for people like this to have in the world, the salt of the earth, the light of the world. And then the claim that he makes about his purpose, which is not to destroy what the law required, but instead to fulfill it. Whether fulfill means to explain it completely, or to live it out totally, or to show its true purpose in the lives of people who are living. It's about the righteousness that is characteristic of the gospel that he will be the substance of. I found in my reading something written by Danny Dodd, Danny's the preacher for the Levy Church, North Little Rock. And by the way, Greeley and Charlie were members of that congregation and worked with it, he told me, for a year beginning his ministry. But here's about the passage that we're starting tonight. I thought this is a useful summary. Here, Christ completely reinterprets familiar scripture, that is for his audience here, with an emphasis on the heart instead of rules. His purpose was to put context, life, and relationship into the text. Now, let me read that again. That's what I'm getting. His purpose is to put context, life, and relationship into the text, where the text is not just a law book with rules in it that you try to get at the what is demanded of someone. Commands were to be fully integrated into all aspects of life, and not merely as a rule to follow, but changing folks from the inside out, while wonderfully impacting relationships. I think that's a good introduction to what we have here in Matthew 5, verse 21 and following. Now, let me try to show us or remind us how it ties together with what we have already mentioned here. The two phrases that will run through the six illustrations that are found in the rest of Matthew 5, and there are six illustrations of something. So what are the illustrations of? Notice that all of these start with, you have heard, just so you can envision this, you have heard, and then what is the other side of this contrast? All right, but I say unto you. So, what does he mean by the you have heard? You have heard that it was said to those of old. What do you think he means? Is it talking about you have heard? Obviously, these people weren't alive where they heard it said to start with. David?
Well, the Old Testament.
All right.
Stated plain fact.
So if they had heard the law read, they'd heard Deuteronomy read, for example, they would have heard some of this said. Are there other ways that this might have applied here? What is another way, Brendan? All right. They would have heard the rabbis. They would have heard the traditions of the elders. They would have heard the commentaries that the rabbis had amassed about all the different laws and so forth. They would have heard not just the law read, but they would have heard what respected teachers said that the law meant. Right, David?
They've also heard from their dads, their granddads.
Yes.
When they
talked about it, like Deuteronomy 6 said, you know, talk about it to your children and so forth. I think that all of these applied, but there is something that is said in the verse or two previous to this that might limit it a little more to what Jesus was actually talking about. Notice that if we back up, verse 21 starts, "You have heard that it was said to them of old time." Verse 22, "But I say unto you," but we've already run across that "I say unto you" statement. Back up to verse 17 and 18. Notice that he says it this way: "Think not that," and he mentions here that "I came to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you." The construction is similar enough that you have to conclude that there is a line of thought that he's already started, that he's following through with. Now, when he says, "I did not come to destroy, but I came to fulfill," that was what he's talking about here. Remember we said last week that to fulfill it, I just summarized this, meant to live it all the way out, to show its true implication, but also to be the one who could say totally and completely how the law was meant to apply. Brennan, you mentioned this recently on a Wednesday night when you mentioned the way this word "fulfill" would have been used in their common speech at the time. And then come down to verse 20. "I say unto you that unless your righteousness exceeds," what? Unless what? All right. So unless your righteousness is greater of a different quality than that of the scribes and the Pharisees, that tells me then that what he meant up here was what they would have heard scribes and Pharisees saying. I believe myself that allows us to narrow down a little bit what he is going to be talking about in this passage. Yes, they would have heard the law read. Yes, they would have heard their families talking about it. They would have heard it explained in the synagogues maybe, but the real problem here is the approach that the scribes and the Pharisees had made the people used to taking with regard to the righteousness of the law. All right, so, okay. I would say that what Jesus is saying here is going to be a good contrast with what the legalism of the scribes and Pharisees is. Legalism in this passage will be understood as not wanting to have the law to have its complete total impact, wanting to do what God wants. But legalism is a way to limit the law's demands so that it condemns somebody else besides you. To limit the law's application so that it applies to what somebody else is doing, where you're able to still feel superior, maybe. All right, so that will help us. I think that will give us maybe something to to use to navigate this passage. Jesus, in these six illustrations, will not be trying to say everything that could be said about either one of these subjects. He will be trying to contrast the what God intended for the law to help people be with what the scribes and the Pharisees had been teaching about how to keep the rules, you see. And that may be, if we bear that in mind, it'll help us as we go along. Now, these six illustrations that Jesus uses in the rest of this passage are ways of showing that real righteousness is also an inward matter. It has to do with your passions. Mine too. It has to do with our passions, our intentions, and really with the nature of our practices, our even our very identities, if I can say it that way. The kind of righteousness that Jesus talks about in these illustrations are going to be addressed to how what God really meant his law to say about who people are and how we are and what we're about and what we are wanting to do and intending to do in our lives. These first two now have to do with two problems. I think they are in the nature of passions. What do you think of when I use that word passions? Passions are
love and hate.
All right, love and hate. Extreme emotions. The passions are the longings, the desires, the emotions that can get out of control, that can be hard to rule. And the two of them that he addresses first here in this section have to do with things that can, let me, how could I describe this? One of them has to do with things that devalue life, devalue the lives of persons, and the other one has to do with things that degrade persons or degrade relationships. And those are two dangers that can come about when passions are not ruled. God gives us passions, including anger and even desire for companionship, in order to bring fulfillment and enjoyment and thrill and all of that to life. But in order to bless us like our passions do, our desires do when they are ruled, they can be dangerous if not ruled, if not controlled. Look at Proverbs 16 and verse 32. Somebody, if you look that up, I think that's the right verse. Proverbs 16 and verse 30. In general, that would apply to both of the subjects that that the Lord describes in this passage here. What does that say? I think I gave you the wrong verse. Okay.
Better a patient man warrior.
That's it.
A man who controls his temper than one who takes a city.
All right. The one who rules his own spirit, his own temper, is greater than one who takes a city. The biblical outlook is one where of all the things that man or human being endeavors to control or to rule, the one that's most important is himself. And there's nothing harder than that. We call it maturity when someone can. This is the way the old American Standard Version reads in that verse. He that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he that ruleth his spirit than he that taketh a city. That's a good refrigerator verse, I guess. Proverbs 16 and verse 32. Okay. And it's a great thought, an important verse. Now, let's look here at this. Remember, we're not trying to say everything about this section that could be said, but at chapter 5 of Matthew now, at verse 21, let me read the whole paragraph, okay, and then we'll go back and talk about it. You have heard that it was said to them of old time, thou shalt not kill. And whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you that everyone who is angry with his brother, some older, I think I read one older manuscript, it says without cause, this has with his brother, shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, I brought another version here. That word raka, this one translates, you good for nothing. Or a possibility is, you empty-minded. So you can kind of see, not exactly a compliment, shall be in danger of the council. And whosoever shall say, thou fool, which is this footnotes, that's an expression, a Hebrew expression of condemnation. It's not talking about his intellect. Shall be in danger of the hell of fire. If therefore thou art offering thy gift at the altar, and there rememberest that thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar and go thy way. First be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift. Agree quickly with thine adversary while thou art in the way, lest haply the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee up to the officer, and thou shalt be cast in prison. Verily I say unto thee, thou shalt by no means come out thence till thou hast paid the last farthing. Now that is kind of gets your attention, doesn't it? Reading that passage here. So let's think about it now. What's the big contrast here between you have heard and I say unto you? What had they heard that the law said? All right, you have heard. You've heard it said that the law said you shall not kill, and that technically, then, if you think about the meaning of that, that means, in fact, it's translated this way in most of your version: you shall not murder, whoever shall kill. In other words, now you've heard, according to what you've heard, what would you have to do to be in danger of the judgment in view of this commandment here?
Kill somebody.
So that would mean that technically I could be sitting here seething at Josh. I'm not, but technically I could be. Or I could be sitting here gritting my teeth at Brendan. Or I could be sitting here meaning to get Burl when he turns the other way and walks up the hall, and I'd be all right because I haven't yet physically done it. I could I could refuse to look someone in the eye. I could harbor bitterness towards somebody in my heart and life. I could hole up in my little office at home and not ever talk to anybody and not ever encourage anybody and not ever try to speak to anybody. And technically, I hadn't killed anybody. Therefore, I'm in no danger of judgment. What's the problem with that view? Your heart. And would that view build healthy relationships? Would that view enrich life? Would that view be what God meant? Would that be how God is? Would I be in God's image if I took that? So you see that. So look at what Jesus says about this. But I say unto you. So I say here. And notice that there are two. Is the change here going to be in what the law said or in how the law applies? Is Jesus changing the law? No, he's fulfilling it, right. He is saying what the law meant. He's saying how the law applies. And that in itself is a huge claim if you think about it. Now, look at what he says here. I say unto you, and then there are three whosoevers, or whoevers, or anyone who. First one is whoever is, what does that phrase is, that word suggest to you? Is angry with his brother. It is a continuing state, right? Now, what Jesus is getting at is not every thing that needs to be said or could be said on this topic at all, but he's contrasting how limited an application they had heard the law have. This is, what is this? The sixth commandment, I believe it is. And they were taking a view of life which meant as long as you don't snuff it out, you're good. Jesus is saying life is so valuable and so sacred that you don't want to be so preoccupied with anger that you develop the situation here where you say to your brother, raka, which is a term of contempt. This is an insult here. So this is a state of contempt toward another person. You're angry and a state of contempt for them as a person, not what they have done necessarily. But then the third thing is you fool. And this is a term here which means condemnation, where you condemn another person. All right. That is the alarm flag that Jesus is trying to raise here, where we settle into a permanent state of this kind of thought, where who is it that really is defiled by this? All right. It's not you if I feel that way toward you, even though that's devaluing life, but it's me. If this is going on inside of me, and if this is what I'm saying, then there's the problem where Jesus talks about the danger that's there. You can be, he says, in danger of the judgment, verse 22, first part, in danger of the council of the Supreme Court for the Jews, or in danger of the hell of fire. The word for hell, as you may know, is Gehenna. Anybody tell me where that term derives from? That's right. Called the Valley of Hinnom. Right. And that's where the trash thrown out there. There's always a smoldering fire. There's plenty of maggots wiggling around in the garbage heap and so on. And it's not a literal bit where you're cast out into the Valley of Hinnom, but this is a way of illustrating the fate of a life which is ruined and is lost in that way. Now, before we deal with the Lord's cure for that problem in verses 23 and 24, let's think for a minute about where this starts here. Is it wrong to feel anger toward what someone else may say or do? Is anger wrong? What purpose does anger serve in our lives? It helps us cope. It is a safety valve of response to injustice or unfairness or to unrighteousness. I've read that anger is to the spirit or to the soul of man what pain is to the body. What function does pain serve in our physical bodies? Tells us that something is wrong. One of my brothers one time got his arm injured, and it severed the nerve up here that served the rest of his hand. He couldn't feel, and he'd get a blister or something on a thumb or a finger, and it'd be a serious matter for him because it could get infected, and he wouldn't even know it. And that's what pain. Now, what happens to our spirits without anger is that we start feeling worthless, and we start feeling an indifference toward life. Nothing matters anymore. Why care? Why try? God doesn't want us to feel that way. And so we have a part of Him in us that's capable of being angry with what ruins what we love. That's natural. So when does anger become wrong? Use that Proverbs 16:32. All right. When it is out of control, when it is not guided by a principle greater than itself, that's one big problem. Can you tell me what else can we do to make sure that anger does not get outside of its proper role? Look over to Ephesians 4 for a minute. And I think myself we're dealing with an important matter here. Sometimes something that gets misunderstood. And this is going to be important for the rest of what Jesus says in this paragraph, I think. Over in Ephesians 4. When Paul begins to describe the behavior of the new man, Ephesians 4, 26 and 27. Becky, read that for us, if you would.
Be angry and do not sin.
All right, stop for a minute. So it is possible to be angry and not to sin, right? I mean, that's what you'd make of that. So how is that possible? Go ahead, Becky.
Do not let the sun go down on your anger.
All right, or I think the word could be translated provocation or wrath even. Don't let the sun go down on it. What's that mean? All right, take care of it before you go to sleep. Now, in marriage, this is a hard one. At least from my experience, maybe not for you. Maybe not for you. And don't you go tell anybody in the yellow room I said this. But you know what I mean. This requires us to value relationship enough that we resolve the anger as far as it depends on us. Now, that doesn't mean that you're always going to have the other person agree with you. Sometimes you can say how you feel to the person you love. That's all you're looking for. Sometimes it can lead to an apology and a resolution to the problem in that way. And sometimes it just leads to understanding. Oh, no wonder you acted that way. That's how you felt about it, you see. So first thing is you don't let it linger. You don't dwell on it. You don't nurture it. You don't nurse it. What is your favorite way of letting the other person know that you're angry? No time for pride now. You can say it and I won't go tell anybody. We just broadcast it everywhere here. All right, silence. All right. There is a time, and it is wise until you're able to talk without letting it get away from you, it's better to be quiet. Count to five, count to 10, count to 100 if you have to. Okay, Susie?
I walk away.
I'm with you. The other room, you know. Nothing illustrates the disgust more than just to walk out, you know, that idea. Problem is, that's not very good for a relationship, right? What's another way?
You say yes, dear.
So some form of that's not exactly sarcasm, is it? It is all right. I'll go along with this. I'll agree with this, you know, that type of thing. Humor is a way to do this. Just time is a way to do it. But some way or another, we have to know that our feelings have been valued. That's really all most of us are looking for. We're not looking for everything in the world to be set right. We're just looking to know that we count, that we matter too. So that's first. Don't let the sun try to resolve it in a timely way. Don't, or if it's not important enough to resolve, what's the other option? It can be let go, right? It may not be important enough to risk relationship.
And then verse 27.
Yes.
So do not let the devil have an opportunity.
I mean,
it's pretty important.
It is. So the reason I saved it is the American Standard says neither give place to the devil, like it's two different things. So how did you give place to the devil? Anger is like throwing the door open and saying, come on in. You know, I it is a way for us to let bad thoughts and bad things find our home in our hearts. That's one way to do this. All right, Tom?
Yeah, it's been one of your lessons sometime in the past. I think it's by Nelson Mandela. You know the quote?
I don't know the quote. I can remember.
Something about it was something about hating your brother, revenge against your brother's life.
Yeah, I remember now. Yeah, and that illustrates the point, doesn't it? And all right, so look at James chapter 1 is another place that says something that might help us to manage anger in a way that's healthy for us. James chapter 1. And you will have maybe thought about this in the context of just what comes after it, but what comes before this is dealing with trials and temptations. And then what comes after this is getting the filthiness out of the heart and taking in what the Lord says and going on with it that way. But look at verse 19 and 20, James chapter 1. Somebody have that, want to read it?
So then, my beloved brother, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath, and the wrath of man is not produced by righteousness.
Okay. So what advice with regard to anger would that offer us? All right. First, become the kind of person who is not just waiting to be offended, not easily picked off, you know, the way we'd say it that way. Second, listen first. Be swift to hear. Now, are you busting to do when you're angry? I'm swift to say something, to tell somebody off or whatever it is. This takes the opposite approach. This is such a relevant thing in our culture right now. Just on the news tonight, sitting down there, getting ready to head over here, and it still comes on about, I forgot what city it's in, but man, on this busy freeway out here, two motorists get into it, and they just stop right there in the middle of the road, and first thing you know, the other one's over there. They call it road rage. They're about to jerk the other one out of the car. One picture I saw, this guy swinging a machete around, even just to illustrate. Okay.
About 3 or 4 weeks ago, we had a case of right down here on 44.
Did we?
Killing me.
Goodness. So the wrath of man does not work the righteousness of God, does it? Swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. Try to understand in that way. Now, anyway, what Jesus is telling us here is that killing is devaluing life. And yes, there are other paths. This isn't talking about what the state might do to hold the wrongdoer accountable, or this doesn't settle all the questions about wartime and all that. This is talking about personal behavior, and what Jesus is saying is there's more way than one to devalue the life and the person of another human being. And perpetual anger that develops into a state of contempt and expresses condemnation. In our life right now, the kind of stuff that gets said, either verbally or on social media or in print by one person and about another human being, is so ugly not all the killing takes place out on the street. I'll say it that way. You can murder someone's reputation and someone's good name also. And that way, that maybe is something that the Lord would remind his people about here. Now, come back to Matthew 5 again. Let's finish our paragraph. And I don't know if we get to start the other one or not. So what solution does Jesus offer? I believe myself that he deals with two cases in verses 23 through 25. One of verse 23 talks about your brother. Verse 25, he talks about your adversary. And he proposes two solutions to the problem of anger. And the way he says the first one surprises me. He's been talking about being angry saying to your brother, Raka, and then you fool. And then he says, first one, if you are offering your gift at the altar, you're dealing with your obligation to God. And this is what surprises me. There you remember that your brother has ought against you. Wait a minute. I thought if the problem is my anger, it would mean that I had something against my brother, right? Wouldn't that be what you'd expect? Why do you think Jesus says it this way? Where does the cycle of anger and contempt and condemnation really get? How do I really break through that cycle in life? All right, it could mean, but he says here, though, yeah, it affected our relationship, for sure. But I remember that my brother has ought against me. I think what the Lord is saying is, then you take the initiative and you be the one who interrupts the cycle without the issue having already been settled, and first be reconciled. Now, what does reconciled mean? Brought back together, right? To make friends again. I have found this, I've heard this phrase used for all kinds of different situations. I've seen one brother told me one time, I'm not going to take the Lord's Supper anymore because I have someone I can't get along with. That isn't what Jesus is calling for here. Another guy told me one time, I don't think I can come to church and worship God because there's somebody that I've not been able to get along with. Jesus is not trying to, that's not the issue that he's talking. The issue here is, as far as it depends on you, you take the initiative to try to heal your relationship with your brothers, and then both of you together can offer something to God. This chapter is going to become clearer. He's talking about things in context of the family of God, and I just will tell you, I've had people that I have not now. I don't think there have been a whole bunch of them, but I have some cases where I haven't been able to set things right with someone. Sometimes, my friend Bobby Dockery told me one time, there's some things where the only thing you can do is live it down. Keep on doing what you should, but if you remember, preparing to offer yourself to God, it makes you introspective and you remember that there is a case that where someone has something against you, then you go first and be reconciled to your brother. I think verse 26 is going to say something about the spirit of this, but that's the thing. And then the second thing is agree with your adversary quickly. If you don't want to have a situation where you have to live by a strict code of rules and that's it, wherein any time there is a rupture of the rules, someone has to measure up on some technicality in order for you to agree with that person or to accept that person, then you're going to be in for a frustrating situation. So agree quickly with your adversary. And the reason for that, it's kind of practically funny when you think about it. If you're going to insist on your rights down to the letter of the law, black and white, then you're going to have some times where somebody's going to hold you to that standard too. Yeah, Tom.
That's going to be awkward, but Uncle Fred Wilson used to say, never do business with your family. Remember the church.
I heard him say that one time. And he would say that with a grin too. And I learned that your Uncle Fred had a lot of those kind of sayings written in the fly in the page of his Bible there, Tom. What a fellow. What the Lord says is, take action while you can. This is the reason for the quickness here and for the readiness to be reconciled. If you don't, then this is going to get delivered up to the judge. And then the judge is going to deliver you to the officer. Then the officer is just going to fulfill his duty, and you'll have to pay the price of that down to the last drop. So what he's saying is you don't want to live that way. Now, again, this doesn't settle every issue that we ever wonder about, but can you see how this puts the whole discussion in a different light? We've moved from things go wrong, the only way you can settle it is just kill somebody, to human life is not perfect. We have things that stir our anger and can become the worst kinds of passions that develop into contempt and condemnation. What God really wants when he says this is if you're going to value life in a world where neither you nor other people are perfect, you're going to need to learn to be reconciled first and to agree quickly where there's been some problems. You don't agree quickly, then it develops into deepening feelings of this, and then there are real problems. And all that we have to do to see the value of this is to look at the world today. Now, just for a minute, and I heard the first bell. Which of the Beatitudes does this teaching fulfill or call for? Which of the Beatitudes are necessary in order for us to listen to Jesus in bringing the law to its fulfillment in this way, where anger is concerned and where valuing of life? All right, that's the second great commandment of the law. But the Beatitudes in verses 3 through 10, which ones of them come into play in this? All right, so you said the meek, which means the ones who don't have to have their rights. What else? All of them. Okay, That's what I was hoping you'd just say. You know, the poor in spirit, which means I know I've got my problems too. Those who mourn over how things are, where we fall short in life, is better than those who are angry with it. Hungry, the meek, who are, that's gentle strength. The hungering and thirsting after what's right, being merciful, having pure, unmixed motives, being peacemakers, being willing to be persecuted for righteousness' sake. That starts to look awfully practical, doesn't it, when you get down to it? I appreciate you guys being with us for class tonight. Anybody else have any other comment to make or any other announcement? Susie?
Really interesting, because I've dealt with our grandson, and well, sadly, I mean, temper was so critical that, you know, he had a good therapist. This was when he was younger, too, and he was in trouble. And, I mean, every little thing they did, he could hurt somebody
and get into fights. But I talked it up part of it. He lost his mother.
Yeah.
So we had to kind of cope with that. But he's gotten some help. And this was when he's younger, all the time we had to worry. And when he was tiny, I could hold him until he got older. But as he got older, that's worse. But now he's in high school till the end, and seems like that helps him.
Yeah.
Curb his temper. And so I've been doing a lot of practice doing
Well, you notice. You notice that our whole culture has a lot to do with this. It's quite personal for me. Let me just tell you all this before you go. There's no charge. We're on free time here. I got to sit down with five of my brothers Sunday evening down home, and then Monday too. And I got a picture to prove it. I sat there and talked to my brother Philip. A long time. Philip is the fourth one of us. You know, a lot of you know the circumstances in my family. We lost our dad early on, and I ended up being like the camp counselor a lot of time because I was the oldest of them. So, long story short, I got started to church from an argument with my stepfather, really. After about a year and a half, I decided to obey the gospel. Life, however, went on the same way, and I got left with the kids and my brother Philip. We settled our issues ourselves, but it wasn't always by agreeing with our adversary quickly. So we got left, and the way this would work is, we get left, and I'd get left with the instruction, all the things that we were supposed to get done, and I was supposed to see that they all got done. Well, with seven little brothers, not all of whom were always eager to do the chores. Sometimes the relationships deteriorated a little, and they did that day. Now, y'all remember, this is the week after I obeyed the gospel, right? Or maybe 2 weeks. So this degenerates. Philip, you got to do this. I don't want to do this. You got to do this. I'm not going to do this. You have to do this. Make me do this. So you know where this ended up? So I had him down on the ground. My knees finally, all of the wiggling and kicking and hollering around in the mud, probably, and I'm not going to let you up until you promise you'll do this. And Philip, in his deep frustration, finally said, "All right, Christian, I'll do it." That's my introduction to anger and Christianity in real life. "All right, Christian, I'll do it." I thought of that last Sunday when we were talking to him. I didn't tell him I thought of it, but anyway. Thank you all for being with us.